So in keeping with the theme of waking up in the midst of it all, I thought that it would be most useful to kind of reprise some of what I did here in December, just some of the topic area where I think I entitled the weekend Loving the House That Ego Built. Because I think that what perhaps keeps us from being awake in the midst of it all, more than anything, keeps us from a state of balance and equilibrium, of open-heartedness, is the misperception or the non-recognition of the inherent vulnerability of our personality views and our sense of ourself, and the enormous proliferation of self-talk and self-stories that go through our mind. Does that seem to resonate with your own experience? And so it's a central challenge and central practice for each of us is learning how to use our very challenging personality views and feelings that we dealt with somewhat today, but using those feelings as our doorway of awakening, as our manure for Bodhi that we talked about earlier today. And this is with the full understanding that whether or not we are new meditators or old meditators, each of us, because of our conditioning, almost built into our brain structure, our DNA, is this very strong habit of entering into the imaginary world of me. And living our lives out of the filter of there being in some way an independent me that lives apart from all other things. This metaphor I often like to use, the one I borrowed from the Bhagavad Gita, that we're the one wave that has arisen on the ocean, but somehow we've gotten separated from the ocean. And somehow we have to, in the drama of our lives, we have to find our way back to the ocean. And forgetting that the wave is never separate from the ocean. It's delusion. But each of us has this condition, this kind of conditioning. An example that I thought that you might find that's particularly relevant to me being here this weekend. And this is the portion of the talk where I do what's called in the Tibetan, in the Zen tradition, confessing my delusions. And we could all confess our own version of this. Each of us, I would say, whether we like it or not, even if we have good, sincere hearts, and we know we've touched and know our deepest nature, we still are visited by the winds that blow through our lives, the winds of praise and blame, the winds of fame and shame, pleasure, pain, gain, loss, you know, the whole thing. You've heard these eight worldly winds. That's what blows through everybody's life. Nobody is immune. And it goes back to that first truth. In this fathom-long, if you're the very definition of birth, it's the leading cause of the eight worldly winds, the leading cause of stress. So just before, about a week before I came here, a couple weeks before I came here, I led a retreat, which I've been doing. In fact, I've shared this community in Houston, Texas, and a lot of the Texas communities. I lead a retreat every year in Austin, Texas, and Houston, Texas. And, you know, Rodney has been going there we've both been going there for more than 20 years. And I have, over the course of the 20 years, I have fallen madly in love with the community there. And they, I would say, without being too grandiose, they've fallen in love with me. And we have this love fest when I lead retreats. You get to know people, and it's just a beautiful thing, this beautiful sharing. And I already love you, and I hardly even know you. But I came home from this retreat just so full. Just the natural feeling of having had praise, that was part of it, but also just the sharing of the Dharma and doing what I love to do. But I was feeling very full, and I'll for the purpose of the story, I'll say full of fame and praise and success and pleasure. So I had all the positive side of the worldly winds blowing in my mind. And although my flights were delayed, I ended up getting home late at night and climbed into bed at midnight, and I was so wired that I thought, oh, maybe I'll just check my email. So in my email box was an email from Rodney sharing an email that he had gotten from somebody who had attended my retreat here in December, saying, Howard spent the first... I shouldn't say this, but I don't think the person's here. And I think she would be fine with it, because I'm not going to... I'm not critical of her right now, anyway. See, this is the house... This is the fragility of the house that Ego built. But the note said, Howard... First, Rodney says, well, this is a group of experienced meditators, and I never hold back, so don't hold back. And I never had the thought of myself holding back, but the person complained that I didn't stay on the topic. I spoke about the Buddha almost much of the first day, and this is a group of experienced meditators. I've done a lot of practice, and that perhaps my $70 would be better spent on dog food. It wasn't exactly in that. It wasn't exactly as bad as it sounds. It was very genuine. The person has limited resources, and many people do. But maybe it would be better to spend it on dog food. So. I went from the one side of the worldly winds to the other side, from inflation to the feeling of deflation, and I could feel myself, oh, she didn't, why did I talk about the Buddha? To show how he came to see through this self-illusion, and he didn't get it, or whatever. And so you can see the defensiveness, and this is what normally happens when the house of ego, the house that we build around one of these winds, gets inevitably knocked off its dependency on one side, on the side of pleasure, success, etc. It falls, and no human being wants to, initially anyway, until they've discovered the open secret. Nobody wants to feel what it's like to crumble, to feel that house crash to the ground. And I'm being exaggerating when I'm saying crash to the ground. Fortunately, I was having somewhat, because I've been playing with this myself, I was having a little fun seeing, even though I felt it. In fact, there were moments, the moment I read it, one of the things I laughed at is, I don't want to go there. Which, you know, literally 10 seconds later, I saw the complete humor in it. Because I had a really wonderful time with you the last time, and delighted to be with you. But I could see the way that the mind was working. And so all of us have our version of inflation and deflation. We all have narcissism. We've all built our identities around what I call a house of cards, around an idea, around our body that's getting old, sick, dying, unreasonable, doesn't cooperate, through our mind that's constantly moving, our emotions that are ever changing and unreliable, and all these worldly winds, that the externals, just dealing with people and their perceptions and our ever-changing sense experience and pleasant, unpleasant, continually rolling back and forth. So in the course of our lives, this happens every single day in one form or another. And that road less traveled, that open secret, that very crumbling feeling, that very vulnerability, that very fragility that is inherent in the house that gets built again and again and again, that inherent vulnerability is our Dharma door. It is a place that, if we can open to it, opens us to that ground, to a feeling of being home in this very moment, in this very life, independent of what's happening. In the not feeling of the, when we don't let ourselves feel our fragility, feel the impact of somebody's praise or blame, our life becomes an endless series of, innocent as they may be, an endless series of deflections, distractions, and an endless pressure to keep building, defending, protecting, even enlightening the imagined me. And often often our practice can take on this kind of ambition to have a better self, to have a better me. And this may seem very innocent, but it sets us up for a lot of greed and grasping in the mind that then exhausts us, makes us tired, makes us tense. And it's that same mind that, I'm not sure if this is driving what you spoke about today, but very much in our practice there is a tendency to have our search for special experiences is some way a search to not just to validate practice but to validate ourselves. And many people describe the striving mind to create, to just get somewhere. And this is what the Buddha would call greed in the mind, one of the three poisons that gets into our mind. And this is often the way that our mind and our heart moves in relationship to our vulnerability. On the other hand, if I felt the pain of that deflation, we'll call it a narcissistic wound. If I just feel that wound, that I built my house around something that was so fragile, and I actually feel that, then that being absorbed into the light of attention, of awareness, and this can happen anywhere. If you stopped at work when your boss yelled at you or belittled you or didn't see you or didn't recognize you and you felt that fragility, that becomes a moment where that feeling, maybe not immediately, it may not be particularly pleasant, won't necessarily go away, but it will get absorbed into the ground of attention, into the effect that attention has on whatever it meets, which is it brings balance. It brings more faith and trust in awareness, more faith in the capacity to be with things, and in fact creates the conditions for that feeling then, as we've been talking about throughout the retreat, for that feeling to arise and pass like the weather that it is, rather than have it be the cause of building another more insecure monument to the imagined me. And part of the issue that the tendency that keeps us from just letting ourselves rest in the ground of, I call it rest in the ground of nobody. You know, if you've heard the line, everybody wants to be somebody. Nobody wants to be nobody. But if that somebody could just be nobody, that nobody would really be somebody. But one of the things that keeps us from resting in that ground of nobody, in other words, the way I think of it is that being nobody is really completely being ourselves. And when I say nobody, I mean stepping out of the idea of ourselves and into the open expression of ourselves and all that flows from that. We don't trust that so much. We think of, if I was nobody, then I'd be nothing. But remember that quote from Kahlo, in being nothing, I am everything. I have everything available to me when I'm not busy, caught in the narrow vortex of my self-preoccupation. I'm just open. Who was I telling, one of the last little groups, that seeing through the illusion of ourselves as independent, self-existing, that there's something in us that's apart from everything, seeing through or expanding the view of what we are beyond our limited little shaky virtual idea to that interwoven, interdependent being, actually expresses itself as each individual, that unique expression of life that each of us is, that individual being able to just more be ourselves. Now, recently I was leading the retreat, in an annual retreat that I've been going to for, both as I started as a yogi, went then managed the retreats in the early 80s, then started teaching them in about 85, and pretty much for 30-something years I've been going to this same retreat in the desert. And I was sitting, this time I taught the retreat with 7 other teachers. There were 8 of us. Talk about a narcissistic minefield. But it wasn't that at all, because each day, because I didn't give a discourse until the 6th day, each day I just sat and watched my colleagues do what they do. And each one, through all of their realization and their understanding, they were just, the biggest difference from years and years ago, that they were just more themselves. They weren't busy trying to be somebody. They weren't posturing. There's not so much more, less self-consciousness, embarrassment, worry, much more just the flow of that unique expression of life that each of you is. And it reminded me, and I said this at the time, of what it's like to be a dad. You know, I have this incredible little 7.5-year-old daughter whose name is Molly, and watching her unfold, she has this, I call it, she's just such a unique expression of life, as all of us are. She has what I call Molliness. And she couldn't be like anyone else. She's been moved by the forces in the way that she is. And she's just completely Molliness. And nor should she be like any... But it's obvious that she is an individual, but you can see that she's made up of all these non-personal causes and conditions, all the forces that have influenced her life. But there's pure Molliness. And I can see, day after day, how she's starting to, as most of us do in our daily life, and we've been doing it, how she's moving slowly to what's growing in her in little ways. And how does it grow in us? Commonly through mirroring, through the comparing mind, through seeing others and differences. She's growing the virtual version of Molly. She's growing the imaginary Molly, who wants what she doesn't have, who doesn't want what she has. And the Buddha called the wanting mind and the aversive mind, he called these the maker of measurement. And so I can see that she's now moving into living in moments in what the Buddha called pride and conceit, or mana, called the otherwise known to us as the comparing mind. That tendency to put, she's not elaborated to the extent that we are, but the tendency of mind to put ourselves above, below, or equal. And so we're continually building a house of measurement based on our wants or our dissatisfaction, what we want, what we don't want, what others have. And this version of ourselves that plays through our mind, daily life, right in the middle of it all, is a version of someone, I always like to say, that doesn't exist. It's a fictitious version of ourselves. It's not even just the basic psychological version. It's one that one could never find in real time. You could never find the one who is measurable here. In a moment, in the moments of immediacy. What can you say about yourself when you're right here? Can you say, in your immediate experience of just opening the senses, can you say, I'm above, below, or equal to? What does that mean anyway? Who does that refer to? I'm good, not good enough, I'm better than, I'm this, I'm that. Of course, these feelings may roll through our mind, but those are just apparitions in a way. They're part of our lives and we have to feel them. But they often reflect living in that imaginary version of ourselves. So the beauty of practice, even in the midst of it all, is we can start to notice. Not just start, we can continue. And those of you who practice, inevitably will see in the course of your daily life, you'll see the comparing mind. You'll see the mind that's measuring. There are three kinds of mana, three kinds of comparing mind. There's what the Buddha called atimana, which is, I'm a little better than. That's the mind that's being critical of others and kind of saying how they should be. Or building up or inflating ourselves. And we could do that physically by, as my friend James says, by the one of the ego trips to watch. He calls it looking good. Or the way that we, our mind, and of course our body is affected by these different views as they come and they go, kind of shrink, and that reflects not enough, and it enhanced by fear, and our body of fear. We can notice that. These produce a lot of fragility. They produce a lot of vulnerability. This, even the inflation, even though it's temporarily, you're all pumped up, it's a house of cards. And so when you see this, at first people are really, really annoyed by their inflation. Any of you been annoyed by your egotism? What that egotism needs is not the second arrow of annoyance. It needs to be loved up. It needs to be appreciated as an innocent but futile attempt to build a house that's secure. It's just not securable. Rather, use it to let it be the cause of kindness and mercy, compassion, self-compassion. Because otherwise, if we don't have self-compassion, I actually brought a quote about this that I picked off the internet. I'll tell you how I got it. But a quote about it makes us try so hard. It makes us so compulsive, and give too much when we actually don't meet our insecurity with love. And this is from the yoga teacher to Lady Gaga. Lady Gaga's yoga teacher. I'm crazy about Lady Gaga. I don't know about you. I think she's extraordinary. She's onto something about non-self-consciousness. She just goes. And there's something very inspiring about her. But she has her own issues. And her yoga teacher says, I knew her before she was Lady Gaga. Became Lady Gaga. And she was creative, brilliant, and giving. Everything she gave out was so super generous and clear. And then she had problems with so many people wanting to be close to her. It was hard for her to distinguish who was genuine and who was not. If she were more compassionate with herself, I told her, everything would be clearer. If she focused more on herself, she could keep giving like she did before she was Lady Gaga. So that's kind of the backstory. But this is the pithy line, I think. Questioner says, do you prescribe self-compassion to one and all? Most Americans don't have a lot of self-compassion. To be successful, to improve themselves, they try to motivate themselves with self-criticism. I don't think self-criticism is motivation for change. If it were, there wouldn't be so many yo-yo diet books out there. I think self-compassion is all the motivation you need. If you do incorporate self-compassion, eating healthy is easy. If you like yourself, you put the right things in your body, and the benefits explode from there. So you can extrapolate to anything that needs wisdom and care in your life. It starts with self-care. It does not start with self-criticism. But paying attention to that house that ego builds in our daily life tends to initially bring the tendency towards self-criticism. But fortunately, over time, you can start to have a sense of humor about your ego trips, about your narcissistic deflation and inflation. Whoever wrote this anonymous poem had a sense of humor, saw the way that we build compare ourselves to impossible ideals, and then kind of make ourselves miserable with it. This person says, if I'm hesitant to read it because probably most of you have heard this 100 times, but if you can start the day without caffeine or pep pills, if you can be cheerful, ignoring aches and pains, if you can resist complaining and boring people with your troubles, if you can eat the same food every day and be grateful for it, if you can understand when loved ones are too busy to give you time, if you can overlook when people take things out of you, when through no fault of yours something goes wrong, these are some of our spiritual ideas. If you can take criticism and blame without resentment, if you can face the world without lies and conceit, if you can conquer tension without medical help, if you can relax without alcohol, if you can sleep without the aid of drugs, if you can do all these things, you are probably the family dog. So the invitation is we won't stop comparing. We won't stop comparing ourselves to ideals, putting ourselves above, below, and equal to. And in that process, we will not stop the fragility and the vulnerability of our different moods that come from that fragile self-view. And so they need, in the middle of it all, we need our attention, because our bodies register that as dis-ease. We register it as crashing of. We register it as fatigue. We register it as restlessness and worry and agitation. We register these things all the time. And what do we normally do when we see that? We make a case against ourselves instead of seeing what it is that we're needing right then. What is that fragile heart needing? It's needing just what any little fragile developing Molly needs. She needs to be held. She needs to be loved up. She needs to be reminded that you don't have to be better than. You don't have to be special. You have pure Molliness. You have pure whoever you are, each person. And that may not have any self. That may be inherently without self. You are. That you are made up of all these non-personal elements, but nevertheless your individuality is here, unique, and in living color, and is just enough as you are. But how do we recover that through self-criticism? You don't. We recover it through loving that being merciful toward that house that's being built all the time. It's helpful to reflect on the movements that our mind makes when we feel that fragility. The way the Buddha talked about it, I'm not going to describe these right now other than to say that our mind goes into it from that place of vulnerability. We tend to, the tension of that spawns our compulsions, like the what the Buddha called papancha. We papancha about things we're angry about. We papancha about things we want, and that's where our mind goes in search. We papancha about views and opinions and build ourselves into a frenzy about political, religious, this and that. And we build We just keep building the personality, the story of that. We build a lot of comparing. So it's helpful to reflect on our non-separateness. It's helpful to remember that we're moving and being moved by life, that we are here at the effect of many causes and conditions. Debating about reading this poem, maybe I'll just read a part of it. This was an interesting poem called Why I'm Here by Jacqueline Berger. This reminds us that we could not be any different than the way we are up to this point. We are just expressing, we are the creative expression of life. We're not just creative people, we are the creativity. That same notion of the divine is in you. It's not the divine is in you. The divine is in you as you. You are the divine expression of life. This is her version. Why I'm here? Because my mother was on a date with a man in the band, and my father, thinking she was alone, asked her to dance. Because years earlier, my father dug a foxhole, but his buddy, sick with the flu, asked him for it, so he dug another for himself. In the night, the first hole was shelled. I'm here because my mother was 27, and in the 50s, that was so old to still be single. Because my father wouldn't work on weapons, though he was an atomic engineer. My mother, having gone to Berkeley, liked that. My father liked that she didn't eat like a bird when he took her to the best restaurant in L.A. The rest of the reasons are long gone. One decides to get dressed, go out, though she'd rather stay home, but no, melancholy must be battled through. So the skirt, the cinched belt, the shoes, and the life is changed. I'm here because Jews were hated, so my grandparents left their villages, came to America, married one who could cook, one whose brother had a business, married longing and disappointment, and secured in his way the future. It's good to treasure the gift, but good to see that it wasn't really meant for you. The feeling that it couldn't have been otherwise is just a feeling. My family around the patio table in July. I've taken over the barbecuing that used to be my father's job. Ask him how many coals, though I know how many. We've been gathering here for years, so I believe we will go on forever. It's right to praise the random, the tiny god of probability that brought us here. To praise not meaning, but feeling, the still warm sky at dusk, the light that lingers, and the light that when it comes is gentle. So I actually am running out of time, aren't I? As usual. So I think I made the point. Please, in the middle of it all, be good to yourself, be merciful, be kind. And I'll end with the entire poem that I gave you an excerpt of yesterday, the entire poem called, by Hafiz, Cast All Your Votes for Dancing. I know the voice of depression still calls to you. I know those habits that can ruin your life still send their invitations. But you are with the friend now. And I'll just translate this right now as you can translate it any way you want, but to me it's that caring heart and that kind attention, that capacity to include and envelop whatever it is that's presenting itself. But you are with the friend now, and you look so much stronger. You can stay that way and even bloom. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from your prayers and work and music, and from your companion's beautiful laughter. Keep squeezing drops of the sun from the sacred hands and the glance of your beloved, and my dear, from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Learn to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment of pleasure, but then drag you for days like a broken man behind that farting camel. You are with the friend now. Learn what actions of yours delight her, what actions of yours bring freedom and love. Whenever you speak of the divine, my ears wish my head was missing so they could finally kiss each other and applaud all your nourishing wisdom. Oh, keep squeezing drops of the sun from your prayers and work and music and from your companions' beautiful laughter and from the most insignificant movements of your own holy body. Now, sweet one, be wise, cast all your votes for dancing. So just for a moment, let's sit quietly and just consider that if there has been any blessing, any benefits, any fruits, any goodness, any merit that has arisen from our time together, and I think there's much, if there has been any, we gather it together, we send it on its way, radiating the blessings of our life and practice in all directions, above, below, and all around, to all the beings who supported you being here, if there are those who supported you being here, all the beings who you hold near and dear, all the difficult people in your life the friction of dealing with them has perhaps brought you to this moment, all the beings in all kinds of circumstances, beings who are being born, beings who are dying, and happy, unhappy, letting the blessings of our practice be shared with all beings everywhere, without exception, radiating a deep wish toward all beings, that all can have happiness and peace in their lives and the causes of happiness and peace, that all beings can be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, that all beings can realize, recognize the sacred happiness that is free of sorrow here and now, and not miss this vital point. And a deep wish that all beings can at least touch that boundless equanimity, able to meet the inevitable joys and the inevitable sorrows, the inevitable inflation and deflation, with less grasping, less aversion, kindness and mercy. A deep wish that all beings can feel free in this very life. And finally, a dedication, a wish that our practice today and every day be dedicated to the welfare and benefit of all beings.